Thank you for coming to this episode of the Divorce Friday podcast. It's a podcast that addresses your financial questions about divorce. So today, we're inaugurating a series on child support, and that is due to partially to the fact that the state of Massachusetts child support guidelines have just been updated and are about to go into effect sometimes next week, I think, right? And so I'm Chris Chen. I'm a certified financial planner in a CDFA in Newton. And Diane?
Hi, I'm Diane Pappas. I'm a certified divorce financial analyst and a certified Quadro specialist. And excellent. My office is up in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
All right. And we have a special guest today. And this is Fern Frohlin, an attorney with Myrick O'Connell in Boston. Fern has been on the past three child support task forces. And she has also been on the alimony reform law task force. And so she is a real expert on the issue of child support and alimony and how they interplay. And we will be addressing that a little bit later. So in the meantime, you can always find our information on the Facebook page. You can look at Divorce Friday on Facebook. And if you haven't already, please like it or follow it. You can find us on Twitter at Divorce Friday, and you can follow us there too. You can reach either Diane or I at divorcefriday@gmail.com. And so at this point, so we have, I mentioned that we have a series on child support for the fall, and it will be running for the next 10 episodes, which are actually 8 episodes in the fall and 2 episodes in January, because we're trying to take time off between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So at this point, I think we're ready to get started. And Diane, do you want to kick it off?
Sure, I do. So Fern, it's so nice to see you and have you here. And you are the most appropriate person to have for our first series on child support, because as Chris said, you've been on three different task forces. And what we would really love to know is more about the task force and what your purpose is. And so I guess our first question might be, why are the child support guidelines reviewed every 4 years?
Well, the short answer is because the federal government requires it. Going back to late 70s or perhaps early 80s, the federal government determined that one way to reduce federally supported what we called welfare payments, then it was age-dependent children, and then now it's SNAP, was to have absent parents contribute to the support of their children. So the federal government mandated that every state have specific guidelines. They didn't say what the guidelines had to be, but they set rules for the procedures for making them and how they should work. Yeah. Over the years, those have evolved. They've changed. The most recent changes were 2017. But since the beginning, there's been a requirement for a four-year review. The longer answer is that the guidelines, according to the federal government, have to reflect economic realities and certain public policies. And the economic realities change and the public policies change. So the four-year review mandates that the state, well, they don't have to make a change, but they do have to look at it every 4 years. And the state can determine what that review is going to look like. In three of the last four quadrennial reviews, so that's over the last 16 years, there has been a publicly appointed appointed by the trial court task force made up of attorneys, judges, probation officers, people who work in the court, and they've tried really hard to have all of the attorneys represent different interests. So for example, this time we had attorneys from the Department of Revenue, which supports child support enforcement. We also had legal services that lawyers who represent payors, and we had legal services lawyers who represent recipients. We had some practitioners whose practice is more toward recipients and others whose is more toward payors. Mine is evenly balanced.
Wow. So I learned something new. I actually did not know that there was a federal mandate out there that every state had to do this with child support. I know that every state has different guidelines, and I would never want to work in another state without having that knowledge. So we stay in our own lane and we stay in Massachusetts. So, but that's, I didn't realize that this was a federally mandated thing. So that's really good to know.
The states are also mandated to do things like keep statistics that show that approximately 80% of the cases that come through the courts, child support cases that come through the courts, are not deviations. They're the the federal government requires a mathematical calculation. The state can say what it is. And then the state has to keep records showing that at least 80% of the cases actually complied with that mathematical calculation. That's why we talk about deviation, and that's what they have to have rules for deviations. There's a lot of regulations. And the most recent ones are, most recent regulations, interestingly, are heavily weighted toward protecting very, very low income, below the poverty line, payors, and making sure that they have subsistence reserve. So, which is why, for example, this time around, you saw that we lowered the curve on the child support payments for the poorest of the poor payors.
Yeah, I think that's people that fall into the annual income of about $10,900.
Yes.
Which that is pretty low.
Yeah.
So I think that that minimum is what, $12 a week?
Yes. Reduced from 20.
Right.
Which is a big reduction. And yeah. Or reduced from 25. So it's reduced by about half. And we also changed the calculation for that it's only based on payor's income. There are a lot of good reasons for it. I don't know if our listeners today would be interested in the reasons why those particular changes were made. But I'm happy to talk about it.
Nope, Chris, I can't hear you.
I think they would be interested.
Okay. So one was this federal requirement that their income be protected in some way. The government didn't say how. They just said you have to think about it and you have to, that their support, self-support. The biggest impetus, and this was really very broadly supported by the Department of Revenue, which is the collection agency, is that under federal law, a recipient of child support who is also receiving SNAP benefits is only allowed to keep $50 a month. So the money that was being collected from the payor, if it was in excess of $50 a month, hence the $12 minimum, okay, payment, it was going to be a pass through back to the government to repay the SNAP benefits. Hmm. The second one, biggest impetus, is that in order to bring an action to enforce child support, you can order anything, but if you're going to enforce it afterward, if it's not paid, you have to prove that the payor could pay. And there's no point in bringing actions against people without the money to pay the orders. So the orders weren't enforceable anyway. Those were really the two biggest reasons that was very much lowered on the low recipient end.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's something that when we started working on child support, that I did note is that you could be mandated to pay even if you have zero income.
Yes, well, because one of the original policies, and this is the changing policy and hence the reviews, was that all parents have an obligation to support their children. So all means all. Mm-hmm. And the orders were originally for everyone to pay something. Right. Over time, you know, the reviews, I think the guidelines reviews over time, you know, with few exceptions, trying some things that sometimes don't work, have vastly improved the fairness of child support. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
One more thing about the in this review part, I also was reading, I did read the economic report, kind of, sort of. It's very long. But one of the things that was mentioned is that Massachusetts has one of the highest childcare costs in the states. So is that another reason why the guidelines were kind of restructured to take into account our higher costs? And obviously, as every year goes on, costs go higher. And we do live in the Northeast in a very expensive area.
So exactly.
Yeah.
We are, in fact, the highest childcare expense of all of the 50 states.
That kind of blows my mind.
Yeah. It's a phenomenal number. The amount of the cost of childcare. Childcare in Massachusetts, on average, which means there are many that are much higher, as well as some that are lower. For a single infant, if you have only one infant in childcare, averages $355 a week. I mean, think about how much that is if you're talking about a $20 order, or a $200 or a $2,000 order, if that's all the money that's coming into the household.
Yep. Yeah,
and that was really the reason, the restructuring that you're mentioning there, is that when we, 4 years ago, recognized that it was time to not just have a deduction for childcare, but to really share the costs between the parents, to make each parent actually pay part of that specific cost. And the task force, the 2016 task force, looked at the numbers that was going to increase child support by. There was a collective gasp. And then what can we do about the sticker shock of turning around and saying to people, your orders are going to go up by X tomorrow? We decided on collectively a pretty arbitrary 15% cap, which didn't have a good underpinning. It just looked like a fair bounce in the orders at the time. And the public was really upset about it. And we reviewed it and looked and said, okay, we're not going to do that. We're just going to take the cap off. We're going to use a benchmark. You'll see, if you read the economic report, dense as it is, he keeps talking about benchmarks, the cost for one child for infant care, recognizing, and then it's limited obviously by what you actually pay, but the sharing. And now it's just proportioned to income, just proportional sharing in the new guidelines.
Very cool.
So if one parent has 60% of the income and is paying all the child care, they're going to get 60% reimbursed up to $355 per child.
Okay. So that sort of gets us into the next topic, which is more important changes in the 2021 guidelines. And clearly that is one of them.
We talked about the lower minimum orders. So that's two, and there were five altogether. The one I think that the public was most surprised by, and obviously all the information was embargoed during the year of deliberations, was the recommendation that the maximum income to which child support applies was raised from $250,000 to $400,000. Yeah. Just a huge, big jump all at once, and not without a great deal of debate, I assure you. And then that change required changes to the tables for one child. We have a mathematic table that you look at the table. Here's the combined income. And this is the child support that's going to be apportioned between the two parents. The categories were broadened. Categories were added on at the low end for these very low income payors. And the economist, God bless him, managed to maintain exactly the same curve that we had before with the broader categories. So people's child support should not be impacted. And the intent is, if it is, it's by a couple bucks on the upper side, but very, very minimally. So that's the fourth change. And then the other big one that I think didn't get as much immediate play, but is going to have actually a lot of dollar effect, is increasing the multiplier for multi-children families.
Right. Yeah, that's the one I keep hearing everybody talk about.
So with respect to that increase from 250 to 400, and so what we're talking about is that the currently still, the first $250,000 of joint income are considered for child support. And now with the new guidelines, it's going to be the first $400,000 in joint income. So what drove that increase from 250,000 to 400,000?
That old world word that the economists kept throwing out, which was benchmarks. When we started our review, as we had in the past, every review that I've worked on, we started out by saying we're going to look at economic studies because the federal government says you have to do that. And the best of those is called the Betson study, which was updated in 2020. So it was really good information. And the Betson study tells us the incremental cost of raising a child for a family over and above the cost that family would spend if there were no children in the family. So it's the spouse is really carved out in the Betson study from this is what it costs if my spouse and I decide to have a child. This is the extra cost that we will incur. The second study we used is USDA. We've used that all the time because it's the gold standard that you can argue with it, but we're all accepting it for economic purposes if we live in the United States. That was most recently updated in 2017. And then we looked at local. So those are two benchmarks. The costs really don't fall off the grid till you get to 400,000. So our 250 was old. It also had not been updated since 2009.
Right.
So there was an inflationary change. If you took the 250 and thought about inflation to today in Massachusetts, it would be about 315. We could have just, there was discussion about that. We could have just changed it to 315. But the other benchmarks we looked at were and this is for everything, not just this part of the review. We looked at 9 states. 4 that are contiguous New England states because the cost of living generally is higher in New England. We left out Maine because Maine is a very poor state and not economically similar to Massachusetts. And 5 contiguous states, Vermont, Connecticut, et cetera. And then we looked at the four states that are most economically and demographically similar to Massachusetts, California, New Jersey, Maryland, District of Columbia. And all of them were scattered across the board. Some were higher, their max, some were lower. So that didn't on this particular item, that wasn't very instructive. But when we looked at the United States as a whole, Massachusetts was exactly at the median. And Massachusetts economically is in the top 10%. So that didn't make sense.
Right.
So when we looked at the United States as a whole, the Betson study, the USDA study, and the benchmark states, and there are some states that have no limit at all, or Utah is $1 million. We decided that the progressive thing to do was increase it to 400. I could say that higher numbers were thrown out, and obviously the 315 that I talked about was thrown out, and that was the decision. These are just policy decisions.
I mean, when I computed some of the numbers and to figure out how it actually impacts cases, and what I find is that there is a uniform increase in child support across the income ranges, but it seems that the increase in child support is much greater for higher incomes than it is for lower income on a percentage basis. And I think that sort of, to Diane and I, sort of makes sense because in the past, when we see child support awarded for higher income people, it never seemed to be enough, right? Was that part of the intent?
I would say no. No. We really stayed with having been a little bit, I would say, chastened by that seemed to be enough 15% cap that we put on the shared child care and health care expenses in the past. Everything we did, we looked at an economic underpinning. I'm not surprised that it's greater in the higher income, you know, ranges, but there was not a real intent to do that. It was a byproduct of what the economics just shows. So your observation is consistent with the economics, which is exactly what you would want to have happen.
Right. And it sort of makes sense because at lower income, there is less income to go around anyway.
Yeah.
Right? And at higher income, there is more flexibility that is possible.
That's right.
The issue that comes up with the higher income is in the past, anything over 250 may have been used for additional child support or alimony.
Well, that's a mistake. And
which part is a mistake?
I'm sorry.
Which part is a mistake?
The assumption that the spouse has to take the leftovers, that alimony can only be paid on amounts not that you have to. Let me strike that. That you have to determine for the, although families do this, the children's first, and then take all that money off the table and say the spouse can't spend any, can't receive any of that money for support. That is historically, culturally, what we have done in Massachusetts. It dates all the way back to the 1980s to the first child support guidelines. The first guidelines, which were done by one judge and one or two practitioners who were reforming everything in family law. The 70s and the 80s were a huge, you know, property division changed and alimony changed and child support, everything all at once. Same-sex marriage came later, but everything in upheaval. They limited child support to $75,000 of payor's income, which even at that time was a pretty low, even in the 80s, was a fairly low number. And all the rest was used to calculate alimony, which was a very high percentage. Alimony was 30 to 35%, which is what it is now,
right.
Taxable. But child support went up to 30% too, non-taxable. And so they were trying, because child support was so high, they were trying to give the tax deduction to the payor on more and more money. And so culturally, historically, we just said, okay, do the child support on the first 75 and then the rest is for alimony. And then as you were observing, Chris, at the lower income ranges, the parents don't get anything anyway. They take care of their kids, which is why the curve for its percentages goes down, because it's true that that lower income people take care of their kids first. And then as they make more and more money, the kids get less and the parents have more. And they also spend and they also invest. So they're spending less and less on their kids. The curve now really follows child support expenditures. If you do that and you say there's nothing for the spouse on all that front-loaded $250,000 or $400,000, then the alimony is always going to be insufficient. It wasn't lost on our task force. I apologize, I won't pick up the package. It wasn't lost on our task force that a spouse with no children, whose former spouse makes $400,000 and is now going to get 25% more or less in alimony, non-taxable, but a spouse with three children is only going to get about 16% in child support. That doesn't make sense. I mean, now we can be intuitive, Chris. I'm totally with you. It doesn't make sense for the support order for one person to be higher than the support order for four people on this $400,000. So what has to happen to make it make sense is we have to get rid of the notion this is not the task force talking, because the task force didn't study alimony. We weren't assigned to do that. We were only assigned to study child support. But what has to happen is you have to do the alimony first, in my view. You have to figure out how much money goes into does the spouse receive for alimony, and the high income cases where there's enough money to go around. And then you have to look at it and say, okay, we'll shift that money, and then we will add it to the recipient's income, subtract it from the payor's income, and now we'll do child support guidelines.
Yeah.
If you do that, you get fair orders across the board, but it's a huge cultural change.
Yeah.
And
there's a
new case that doesn't go so far. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Sorry to throw out cases, but this one is to me so important. Cecilia C versus Amelia A. Calvin C. Calvin C versus Amelia A. That suggests that without saying it, because that wasn't the question before the court.
Okay. So getting to the other point that you had made about the big changes there, which was the number of children, which I think was readdressed here. And so what we find is that the amount of child support now really skyrockets on a percentage basis at the higher income levels for multiple children.
Yes.
Right. I mean, it's significantly higher.
Yes. Right?
And it seems that when you compute the numbers and stuff, it seems that it is more or less, in the same neighborhood, similar to what the old award would be plus alimony.
If it is, that's coincidental.
Okay.
If it is, that's coincidental. And if that means that if you were doing the plus alimony, that wasn't the intent at all. If you were doing the award plus alimony, when you did that calculation, were you doing it plus alimony on the overage or plus alimony on the whole thing?
On the overage.
Okay. So it still may be a different number than you get if you do alimony first. And not all cases are out. Not even most cases are alimony cases.
Yeah.
Most cases are not alimony cases. And that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah, I was at a Greater Newburyport Bar Association meeting a couple of weeks ago that they had on child support, and they had a couple of judges and some attorneys. It was really good. And the judges actually spoke to that alimony, you should maybe do a run a couple of different scenarios, like you just said, with alimony being first, calculating that first and seeing, how it relates to the needs of the family and the ability to pay. So I think that's really, for you, to bring that up, I think it's huge, because that just gives people like us, we do the financial piece, and, that allows us to explore different options and provide it to the attorneys to say, here are all your different options. Let's find one that works and that's fair.
And you will find in the text of the guidelines and in the commentary of the guidelines, lots of authority for doing that. It has been there in the past, but recognizing the problem, the anomaly of a support order for a former spouse who would be entitled to alimony with children is lower than the former spouse alone, we really punched it up. And one of the things that the new guidelines say is that the commentary can and should be used for interpretation of the guidelines. So it's right in there. It's right in there, and it tells you, do it different ways. Figure out what's fair, and figure it out based on not just the kids' needs, because we've separated out the kids' needs, but the kids' needs and the spousal needs.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's huge. And I think it's going, like you said, it's a cultural thing, and it's going to take time, for maybe other attorneys to embrace that, because it's what they've been doing for so long. But from my point of view, I think it's the way I always wanted to do it that way.
Right. conceptually, though, it's difficult, right? Because I remember when the current alimony law was introduced, that there was a lot of talk about doing that, in fact, about calculating alimony first and child support second. And it seems that after a burst of interest in there, the interest sort of died off.
Yeah, I all I can say is that as a lawyer, I would pitch my case to the judge. And today, not doing litigation cases, but just mediating cases, I explain it as I tried to do here to clients of what makes, in this case, what absolutely what makes sense and what is economically correct. We used to say very early on, 80s and 90s, before the first task force that I was on, that alimony was child support was family support. It's so much because it's for families. The federal law does not permit that. It has to be tied to the cost of raising children, nor does it make sense for the non-alimony cases. And the payors were absolutely very rightly upset about, for example, in an out of wedlock case, you know, of paying support that was going to turn out to be the same as alimony for someone that they may have had a very short relationship with and certainly were never married to. And so over time, that separating out, which except for the problem of this cultural only calculated on the overage, makes economic sense. I want to mention one other thing, because I think it's super important. The task force, members of the task force were surprised to find that for leaving aside alimony, the overage child support cases, the cases over 250 or today over 400, that there didn't seem to be a good understanding of how to calculate that amount over. The worksheet actually helps you with that now. It wasn't one of the five changes that I mentioned in the beginning. It doesn't tell you what the percentage is for the children for amounts over 400, but because we know that the propensity to spend on children reduces as people become more affluent, and the lowest percentage, the highest, the part that applies to the highest level of income, is 10%.
Yeah.
Amounts on the child support calculated on amounts over 400 should be something less than 10%, which makes it inherently wrong to either take the average the average child support paid through the entire curve, you know, the percentage that you came out with at the end, the effective rate. And it's also inherently wrong to just rerun it on the overage.
Right.
And apparently that's what people were doing. What the source of that was historically, I can't tell you, but it's intuitively wrong, it's mathematically wrong, it's economically wrong. And so now what the task force has clearly said is you take something less than 10% because we want to stay on that curve. It may be 10, it may be 9, it may be 2, because over 400, remember, it's completely discretionary, it may be 0. What makes sense for this family, and it requires you to do some thinking and not just go look up a number. And then the payor is going to pay the same percentage of that 10% applied to the overage as the payor's share of the over income. And there's a box, right? I think it's 8C, but I'm not positive without it in front of me. Box right on the worksheet that tells you how to do that.
Yeah.
So those numbers are going to be, those overage numbers are going to be lower than they were, but again, our goal wasn't to make it higher or lower, it was to get it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense because there was a lot of misunderstanding about how to run what to do with that income over the 250 and now the 400. So that definitely clears that up.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So let's get into some nitty-gritties, if you don't mind.
I'll try. I don't do numbers on the fly very easily, but I can get a calculator.
Oh, not to worry. One of the key challenges for a lot of people who are going through divorce is how do we define income? Because obviously, many of the payors would prefer that some income is not counted. And so it leads to some conflicts, which eventually gets resolved, of course. But what is considered income as far as child support is concerned?
Well, pretty much everything. It's easier to say what's not income. Okay. So it's active income, your W-2 income, your 1099 income. It's passive income, which is an investment income. You know, right now it's really only recognized investment income, and for listeners who don't talk tax jargon, that means that if your stock goes up 10%, but you don't sell it, you don't recognize that 10% for tax purposes. It's there, you've made 10%, but it's not recognized.
Technically, it's not income. It's not income.
Although there's discussion in Congress about changing that. Sure. I don't think it'll happen because it's a very complicated thing to do. Mm-hmm. But so it's capital gains too. That you know when you sell the stock and you recognize the income, then it's capital gains as well, unless. And we've changed this definition. This was a small tweak in the guidelines review, and it doesn't change substantive law at all, but it was spelled out for the purposes of helping practitioners and the public get it right. If the assets were already divided in the divorce and there's capital gain on that asset, so, I take the house, my spouse takes the stock, the house doesn't, or there's no recognition on the house gains, but there is on my spouse sells the stock, that doesn't count.
Right.
Because, you know, I chose to take the house that's gaining, but it's not being recognized. So that's carved out. And right now today, alimony that's paid from the payor to the recipient is not in the income definition. But the way that I just described doing it, which has been implicitly, not just implicitly, clearly in the new case, Calvin C versus Amelia A, allowed, that would also be alimony from the current spouse would also be income. So we can't help people find it. We can't make money, but we tried to capture everything.
Yeah, no, thank you.
One little tweak on the stuff that was divided in the divorce.
Yes.
And you know, many, many support cases are not divorce cases.
The one thing that I did notice that's new, I don't know why our sound is doing that, But another source of income was added that wasn't on it last time, and that is income from stock options. So that we noticed as a new addition.
Yes, that's part of the clarification of right of what's in, that everything's in. Again, that's at the time of recognition. So if you hold your options and you choose not to sell them, it's not going to be calculated in. And that tends to be, you know, one time or occasional anyway. I guess for some people it's recurring. Under the case law, that was always in, it just wasn't spelled out in the definitions to in the language. There were a lot of language changes in the guidelines as well. But most of them were to incorporate existing law. There's a complicated change to SSDI, which, forgive me, I can't explain. It's not really a change. It's getting people, telling people exactly what to put on the worksheet so that it won't be calculated erroneously. And that's because in some cases where there's disability income, the Social Security Administration I don't know exactly when, pays the benefit to the support recipient and not to the payor. And we had reports of confusion where, not to the person who's actually disabled, where there was confusion and the disabled person wasn't collecting the disability benefit, it was going to the support recipient, but it was still being calculated into the payor's, the disabled person's income. So in effect, they were paying child support on money they weren't receiving. Mm-hmm. And this says to people exactly what box to put the number in, and does the calculation for them. And you can see we've made the worksheet longer again. So
I think it's necessary in order to, you know, this is a complicated thing. And this is, when you have children, this is the first thing that we all look at. And that this is the first thing that parents want to know about. And we can't have that discussion until we define the income. And sometimes the income is very easy. You know, it's gross income if you're W-2 salary people. But once you start getting all these different types of income in there, commission, bonus, the variable income, you know, how do we handle that? So that's why these guidelines are really good, because they add a lot more clarity to that. And if we can't define the income at the beginning of the case, that's one of the issues that causes the problem when you're trying to calculate child support. Right. So, you know, defining that income is like the most important thing we need to do first.
Right. It seems that some incomes are more difficult to figure out than others. And
self-employed. Self-employed.
Self-employed or the business income. And so self-employed is maybe a little bit easier, but business owners have the legal ability to manipulate the income legally. I'm not saying that they're really cheating or anything like that, but they have that ability to change it, to affect that income such that it could, in fact, lower their order for child support and alimony.
So the 2016 task force struggled with that. Mm-hmm. And there's language in the text of the guideline that specifically says that income reported for tax may not be the same as income for child support purposes. So for example, somebody whose business owns their car, and as a result of the business owning the car, the person is relieved of the expense of buying and having a car and maintaining a car. And those car expenses should be folded back into income. And we tried to say that in a past task force, but the problem of actually teasing it out and the practicality is why litigants hire you folks, accountants, you know, not lawyers. Financial planners, you know.
I think the reality there is that business owners will tend to fold a lot of expenses, of personal expenses, in the business, many of which they shouldn't.
Well, that's for the tax authorities. That's not a child support issue, and sometimes that facilitates cases settling. So that in that sense, it might very well be a good thing.
Right.
Anything that helps the case settle is a good thing. Okay.
So another challenge that we find with people who need child support and stuff is dealing with the college expenses. Right. Is the guidelines specify that neither party should be forced to pay more than 50% of the cost of UMass Amherst. And the reality of what happens is that a lot of the time, college ends up being the last item discussed, by which time everyone is exhausted, the parties, the lawyers, everyone else, and then it gets punted down to the future. And it is essentially unresolved because when time eventually comes, I mean, it generates a new conflict. Is there, you know, are there other solutions that might have been considered?
Well, they have to be within the purview of the task force. The reason that we put that limit on was, and that would have been the last time around. So 2016 was that suggestion, was really because the orders were ending up forcing people to borrow money. And as a policy matter, it's lovely if a child can get into the schools that today cost $75,000 a year. And it isn't just Harvard, Princeton, Yale, and Stanford that cost $75,000 a year. There are a lot of private schools that cost $75,000. It's many, many, many that cost $75,000 a year. And the child gets in and the child really wants to go. And perhaps one parent has taken the kid to see that school, you know, before any discussion of how it's going to get paid for, and court's ordering it, and then the people paying for college end up having to borrow. And that task force collectively thought that under the federal regulations, we're supposed to be telling people or setting economic parameters based on income and based on income for most people on a pay-as-you-go basis, as opposed to saving in advance or something like that. All we could tell people to do would be to spend a reasonable amount of the money that they have. And so that limit was put on with a lot of discretionary factors, like I think it says shall not ordinarily. So if you have people who can pay more, then the court can order more. And I think it's easier for judges just to say that's my limit, but we do see some judges ordering more. Because that resulted in some cases in people being penalized for saving for college, there is specific language now, it's either in the guidelines or the commentary, in the college section, this is new with the 2021 revisions, that says a parent shall not be penalized for saving. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you've saved enough money to send your child to a better school or something like that, at least it doesn't lessen the other parent's responsibility. I was surprised to find, and it's in the economic report, really interestingly, there's a myth out there that people think Massachusetts is the only state that orders payment for college, and that's not true. Connecticut can order it up to age 23, and several states can order payments for college up to age 17, up to age 18 or age 21.
I think it's one thing.
And some are different. Right. What?
It's one thing that is different for people who are divorced versus people who are not, who are happily married. And what is that happily married people, I don't think have, strictly speaking, the obligation to send their kids to college,
That's great. I have a friend who's an appellate judge in Florida. And many years ago, he called me. He was doing a case and had to apply Massachusetts law. And he was doing a case and he called me and he said, I got a brief here that says that I can order, or that the trial court was within its rights in ordering a parent to pay for college. I looked it up and that's what it says, but it doesn't mean that, right? No, it means that. There's an interesting history on that. That came from a judge who's now retired. She was the first justice in the Cambridge Probate and Family Court, who was reading statistics on and again, we're going back to whenever the statute was amended to include college and age 23, statistics on the number of children of divorce who went to college as compared with children of the same socioeconomic circumstances going to college. And the numbers for children of divorce were way, way lower. And so she lobbied the legislature for that change, and it did have the intended effect. We can like it or not like it. And then along the way, when we had some judges order college savings or an allocation of expenses for college, when children were under the age of 16 or 15, the appeals court reversed it and said, you can't do that. That the judge can only make a snapshot order based on where people are when they're standing in the court, not what's going to happen in the future. So we can agree or disagree, but that's the law. And it's another incentive to settle. You want to have enforced college savings or an agreement when your children are 5 or 6 of what's going to happen, you can write it in, but you can't get a judge to order it if you ask the judge to make the decision and your kids are not right on the cusp of going.
Yeah, I mean, we find that, I mean, we're in the country, in the state where people want to send their kids to college for whatever their reason is, right? And so it's not really difficult for them to accept the concept of sending kids to college. The difficulty is agreeing on paying for college when finances are as tight as it can be during divorce, right? So.
And also when they, let's just say the working parent has a lot of money, maybe in executive compensation, like, you know, stock options. So they have the ability to sell their stock, their options or their RSUs or stock or whatever to raise money for college. And then that person may also be said, you know, under the guidelines have to pay child support. And that's the biggest thing that we come up against is those parents that it's they're the working parent, the other parent is not, they have to, they're going to most likely pay for college, but they are they also obligated to pay child support since they are paying for college?
So that was addressed in the 2016 task force when we added in the reduction for kids over 18. And again, that's a policy decision. We couldn't say no child support. Actually, the guidelines say it's discretionary, so it could be none, but we didn't feel that the guidelines committee could say zero when the statute says, this is the same statute that I previously mentioned, or the same amendment to the statute. So we didn't feel like we were in a position to do that. And the over 18 reduction by 25% for the first child. And then it's the reason it's less is because the support is less. And so the relief is less when one child goes off to college. But, you know, again, that's going to be case by case. That was not revisited this time around. There was very little discussion of college. The way we worked was, and the way all of them have worked, is that the trial court department identifies topics which encompass everything in the guidelines. They just break it up. So definition of income, relationship to alimony, healthcare and child care costs. And then ask, once the task force members have been appointed, ask them which ones they want to serve on. And the subcommittee meets and identifies problems. And then at the same time, and so we're meeting in subcommittees on your particular interest. Mine this time was relationship to alimony. At the same time, they put out a request for public comments. I believe that you guys commented, right? Didn't you make some public comment? No? Okay.
Oh, we did a public comment. Oh, I did a public comment through MCFM, but not directly.
Okay. All right. Good. By the way, that federal rule that we started out at the beginning talk about requires public input, which is one of the reasons for the 4-year review, is that you have to have a review every 4 years and you have to allow public input. So they put out a request for comments, and then there were public hearings, and then the trial department doing the administrative work and in the meantime, the economist is studying what all the other states are doing and updating all the studies and recommending benchmarks and things like that. And then the trial department administratively throws on a grid for us, an Excel spreadsheet, what what the comments were. So you can see it and you can see what the public is most concerned about. And if a subcommittee didn't identify a problem as being something that, that the people on the subcommittee thought needed it, and it's not showing up significantly, there might be one comment on something, but repeating as a theme in all of those public comments, hearing and written, from the hearings and the writing, then we didn't change it. You know, we didn't change everything just for its own sake, but we did review everything line by line. After every meeting, the trial department drafts a new draft based on what we talked about, and people wordsmith it.
So I think just going back to what you said about the 2000, the payment of college and child support were addressed in the worksheet. I do know that there's different categories for kids over 18, so you can put the number. But I guess what I didn't realize is that kind of the fact that maybe one parent is paying for college is built into that. So you're saying that that still exists. So in essence, you can tell a parent, well, yes, we understand that one parent might be paying more than the other, but it's kind of already built into the guide, into the calculation.
Yeah. And let's look at what your family's going to need. Does the fact that that child's going away alleviate the to college, or that you're paying for it, whatever it is, does that in some way change the need in the household that's received, the recipient household?
Well, thank you for that clarification, because I'm not sure a lot of people really intuitively knew that.
Yes, of course. So I think we're coming close to the end of our topics there. And we thank you so much for being with us here. But so our last question there is, are there items that the task force has left unaddressed?
Or there were on that grid that I just talked about, there were repeated comments of people wanting changes to the Alimony Reform Act. It's statutory. There were comments, many comments from people who don't feel that they should pay child support for children over 18. It's statutory. So the only things we didn't address were things that we had no authority to address. We were very aware and repeated it over and over again. We can't do anything about that. We might agree with you, we might disagree with you, but even defending it in language, defending a statute, for example, I could explain to you today where it comes from without commenting on whether I think it's right or wrong. You know, it's interesting to know where it comes from. But those were the only things we didn't address. If anything was raised by more than a couple public comments or by the subcommittee, it got addressed in some fashion. And a lot of it was as simple as just changing language, you know, and some of them were bigger changes.
Yeah.
So in 4 years, I'm sure there'll be new things and we'll find out what works and what doesn't. We did eliminate the healthcare sharing at the bottom of the worksheet also. That's another tweak. And that really, because the reality of what we, and then, of what we were seeing was that when we put it in, it was already part of a trend, but what we were on the back end of the time in which one parent was paying for healthcare for the whole family. And as more and more companies have become self-insured and the ex-spouse has to pick up their own health insurance, it was so well balanced on most worksheets anyway, that it didn't make sense to have it be a shared expense anymore.
So one question, when does the worksheet go into effect? Is it all, can you already do the calculations on it, or do we have to wait till October?
You can. It went up about a week ago, so you can do the calculations. I have received some inquiries and some complaints about the fact that you have to, after you save it, you can't change it. I'm not responsible for the technical stuff. I passed that along and to the trial court, and she said I was the only person that asked. So I guess if you want something different, I you know, in line with that, only one person commented, it was me, because several people asked me, so I'm telling them, ask the trial court if you want. Mm-hmm. It's up, it's working. I think it goes into effect on Monday.
Yeah, on Monday.
So what kind of complaints did you get? I'm curious.
Oh, that people want to be able to change the PDF.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Okay. I got you. All right. Yeah. I'll tell her.
Right. Yeah. No, well, that's good to know. So people can go to mass.gov and search the new 2021 child support worksheet, and they will be able to input their information just to get a preliminary idea of child support.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This is a really easy way to explain it. It's much better than just starting at the beginning and me saying words.
Well, you know what, Fern, this is one of the most productive conversations that I've ever heard, you know, just really getting into understanding and answering some, you know, the important questions that people want to know, and helping us understand what went behind all of the work that has been done to get to where these new guidelines. And, you know, I think this has been fabulous.
Thank you so much.
You know, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's a really nice opportunity.
A pleasure. Thank you so much for coming. And so we close here, so I need to remind everyone that everyone's circumstance is different, and that the podcast cannot replace a consultation with a professional. And if you are considering divorce, do get one. So we will be back next week with another episode of Divorce Friday, and we will be continuing our exploration of the new child support guidelines. Thank you all for coming.
And as I always say, thank goodness it's Divorce Friday.